On Friday, September 28th, the Norris Group proudly presents its 11th annual award-winning black tie event, I Survived Real Estate. An incredible lineup of industry experts will join Bruce Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, tech disruption, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. All proceeds from the event benefit Make-A-Wish and St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. This event is not possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association, Invest Club, Inland Empire Real Estate Investment Club, Think Realty, Wilson Investment Properties, Coach Fullerton, First Lending Solutions, Property Radar, the Apartment Owners Association, MVT Productions, and Realty 411. Visit isurvivedrealestate.com for event information and see Amazon Prime or YouTube for past events.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Dr. Christopher Thornburg. Dr. Thornburg founded Beacon Economics LLC in 2006. Under his leadership, the firm has become one of the most respected research organizations in California, serving public and private sector clients across the United States. In 2015, Dr. Thornburg also became director of the UC Riverside School of Business Center for Economic Forecasting and Development and an adjunct professor at the school. He's an expert in economic and revenue forecasting, regional economics, economic policy, and labor and real estate markets, and consults for private industry, cities, counties, and public agencies. Dr. Thornburg became nationally known for forecasting the subprime mortgage market crash that began in 2007 and was one of the few economists on record to predict the global economic recession that followed. Dr. Thornburg, we welcome you back to our show.
Nice to be here.
Lots of interesting stuff going on. So the first question I had for you is the end of quantitative easing and the Fed reducing its balance sheet. What's the impact on the economy?
Probably one of the largest impacts is how it is reducing inflation, which I know is an odd thing to say, because every time you pick up the newspaper or go online, I should say, to read the newspaper, almost assuredly you're seeing yet another commentator talk about how inflation is this hugely important negative impact in our economy today. When the reality is, when you look at the Fed reversing its actions, getting rid of that balance sheet, you've watched money supply growth shrink to really the lowest it has been since the middle of the Great Recession. This is broadly deflationary, particularly when combined with relatively slow bank lending. And of course, it flies in the face of Fed policy. The Fed is responding as if inflation is a given and has been, of course, hiking rates along with shrinking its balance sheet. So it's an interesting place we're in.
I don't think we've ever been here before, actually.
Not in recent history. Certainly, we've never had such pervasive lack of inflationary pressures in the U.S. economy. I don't want to say deflationary completely, but we are truly in a low inflation rate regime, and it is absolutely an issue for Fed policy. But the Fed doesn't seem to care. In fact, when we think about what the Fed is doing, hiking short-term rates, pushing that federal funds rate up, flattening the yield curve, I would argue that, yet again, it's a reflection of the peculiarity of our economy today, which is our policymakers running around solving problems that don't actually exist, and in the process, potentially doing more harm to the economy than good. And I think that the Fed is one of many examples of that.
Do you see the 4.1 quarterly GDP growth as giving them more permission to raise rates?
No, because the 4.1% increase was largely driven by the fiscal stimulus plan that was put in place at the end of last year. You saw, of course, personal and corporate taxes being cut pretty sharply, along with an increase in government spending. The strong growth in business investment, the strong growth in consumer spending, the strong growth in government spending were all a result of that fiscal stimulus. Now, remember the other side of this. If you're going to tax less and spend more, that money has to come from borrowing. And, of course, that's exactly what we've seen the federal government do. They have been sharply increasing their borrowing. And it goes back to the sheer hypocrisy of politics today. Of course, when Obama was running deficits, the Republicans were just screaming bloody murder about it. The end of the world. We're pushing the U.S. economy to a fiscal crisis. We're going to be just like Europe and mired in a massive debt failure. And here the Republicans are actually doing it even worse because whereas Obama was borrowing all this money in the context of trying to help a healing economy, the Republicans are doing it in the context of a full employment economy. There's no reason to be using fiscal stimulus. Remember, ultimately, fiscal stimulus, it feels good today, but all that money has to get paid back, and that means through less spending and higher taxes tomorrow. We're simply mortgaging our future for this 4.1% growth rate today, and to me, that's not good fiscal policy.
Where do you see GDP growth for 2019?
I think it's still going to be solid. We'll probably be in the 2.5% to 3% range. I mean, the thing about fiscal stimulus is it gives you a short-term boost, but then it kind of fades off. But the underlying fundamentals are still there. People keep asking when the next recession is going to be. We are now in the midst of the second longest expansion in U.S. economic history. But that by itself doesn't tell you much. In fact, the idea that counting months is a good way of predicting the next recession is a little bit off-putting, to say the least. It's not how it works. Basically, every recession has to be caused by some sort of shock to the system. And to date, we have yet to see something that would rise to that level. That is to say, something that could really push the economy off the growth path it is currently on. Now, they're trying. If we see a continued expansion of the trade war, if we continue to see the Fed push rates up to the point where they flip the yield curve, you could end up in a position where we can start thinking about the end of this particular expansion, but we're not there yet.
Okay, an inverted yield curve. So you're a believer that if that occurs, then the likelihood of a recession increases. Is that correct?
No. Okay. I wouldn't say that.
Okay.
And I wouldn't say it largely because we don't really know the answer to that. Here's the two sides of it. The first side is, Every one of the last nine recessions was preceded by an inverted yield curve. So it is probably one of the strongest indicators that we are about to go into a downturn. However, causation and correlation are different things. That's correlation I just gave you. There are typically other issues at play. The Federal Reserve is typically responding to some sort of growing imbalance inside the economy, the net result of which they are pushing rates up to try and cool things off and thus inverting the yield curve. So in a sense, it's a symptom more of an other underlying problem rather than necessarily a problem in itself. So it isn't necessarily a certainty that we will have a recession, but I would say it's also not clear that we wouldn't have a recession. So it's just yet another stressor or something to keep an eye on. It isn't clear exactly how it would end up permeating itself inside the economy, if that makes any sense.
One of the problems with an inverted yield curve at these levels, that would be a first. So last time we inverted it over 6%, something around 8% the time before that, and this might invert below 3. So what tools would the Fed have that they normally do? They normally reduce the short-term rate quite a bit, 4 or 5 points.
Right.
And this time they wouldn't have that ammunition.
Exactly. So you do exactly what they did last time around, which is go back to quantitative easing. Remember that the point of Fed policy is to get money into the system. And there's three ways of doing that. The first way is to cut the federal funds rate, which makes it cheaper for banks to borrow, which makes banks willing to expand their balance sheet. But that only works in as much as banks are willing to lend more, which can be stymied by both banks' natural inclination to be risk adverse and, of course, current policy regarding lending standards. If, as a result of the failure of federal funds rate, because you can't push it down any lower because you can't get the banks to lend that much more, another way of doing it is to just run around and start buying bonds. You could initially buy bonds from banks, or you can buy bonds on the open market, paying people cash for it. Again, that injects cash into the system, which is considered to be broadly stimulative in the short run. And if that doesn't work, the last system, one we've never used, but could be used. In fact, Ben Bernanke, back at the beginning of his term, talked about this. He talked about, you know, worst case scenario, you can fly around in helicopters and throw $100 bills out the window.
Right.
That's why he had the nickname Helicopter Ben for a long time because of that. Now, mind you, they probably wouldn't fly helicopters around and throw $100 bills out. It would create utter chaos on the ground. But imagine that the Federal Reserve simply mailed everybody in the United States a $200 check. Here you go. Have fun. That would work, right? So, and they could. They have the wherewithal to do that. Remember, they control the money supply, so they can print up whatever they want and send it out. They've never done that before, but it could be done. So they have tools. We don't have to reload the gun, so to speak. That's not true.
Okay. Do you see a chance of negative interest rates?
Not in the short end.
No.
I mean, you know, you saw that happening in Germany at the long end. But, you know, Candy, look, long-run rates have been drifting up lately. I mean, they are 10-year bond is running around 3%. And that's a perfectly reasonable number, given that you have you think about that, it's because of the faster-growing economy we're seeing, right? The last time interest rates were running about 3% was back in 2014, when the U.S. economy was growing at a similar clip to what it is now, when the global economy was growing at a similar clip to what it's doing now. So I don't see rates going into that territory. We have a strong enough economy. There is enough demand for this for money. That rates are going to stay in positive territory.
Well, you just mentioned a 3% 10-year. So we have a 3% 10-year, a 4% GDP growth, or let's say we have 2.5 and 3 annually, and we have basically full employment. Has the 10-year ever been at 3% with full employment? And
I'm sure back in the 50s, 60s.
Okay, but that's very unusual.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's been a while, sure.
Well, but isn't that tell us?
Yeah, I mean, you got to remember, it's been a while simply because we had the high inflation 70s and 80s. But really what we are is returning to in some level, so a degree of historic norm.
Are you concerned about deflation? You mentioned that. And what would cause that?
Well, again, a continued collapse of the money supply would basically end up being deflationary for the economy. Now, mind you, deflation is at best a short-term problem. Worst case scenario is they can start printing money and that's it, no more deflation. So deflation to me is not any sort of a critical issue for the U.S. economy. It's manageable, as the case may be.
Do you have an opinion of what causes the next recession?
Not yet.
Okay.
Not yet. Yeah, I don't. I mean, it's as simple as that. I'm waiting and to watching to see what's going on, but the debt markets seem okay. Real estate markets seem okay. I'm a little worried about Federal Reserve policy. I'm a little worried about the potential for a massive trade shock because of ongoing trade concerns, although now that they have announced some sort of negotiation with Europe, it looks like that may be fading away. A unilateral trade battle with China will not push us over the edge. That would have to be really a global trade battle. And again, this the fact that they're basically backing off on Europe and talking again to Europe about some trade negotiation, which mind you is really just a hysterical irony. I mean, we do have to all appreciate that during the election, again, the candidate Trump was incredibly negative on the transatlantic trade partnership that was going through. And of course, what they'd recently announced was, guess what? yet another a nod towards transatlantic trade partnership. It's exactly the same thing that the Obama administration was doing. So they demonized it, killed it, created trade shocks, brought it back, claimed it was theirs, and said it's wonderful. Welcome to modern politics, people.
I don't enjoy politics at all now. Never probably did, but I despise them at this point, to be honest with you, and I pay very little.
Oh, it's so horrendous. And, you know, I realize that listeners may want to paint me as a Democrat or a Republican as a result of me saying that, but I would note that it's really not about being a Democrat or Republican. It's just amazing to me how politics in this day and age have just devolved to this just sheer level of, I don't know, it's just crazy. It's very much George Orwellian, what's going on out there today.
I end every I Survive Real Estate with asking the panel, you know, what's her last thought? And my last thought is always that I want for at least the next year for every elected official to act like an American, not a Democrat or a Republican. But I know that's completely not likely, but that's what I wish for.
And, you know, I would say that 30 years ago, the Democrats and Republicans agreed on what the problems were, but they would disagree on what the solutions were.
Yeah, that
they had a different policy regarding different priorities, different philosophies when it came to policy. But at least they understood what the problems were. Today, they can't even agree on what the problems are. And we have truly moved into this world of just doublespeak, just political doublespeak. And like you said, people are far more interested in their party than they are in the nation. And it's very scary.
Yeah. I mean, from day one after election, it seems like the whole plot is how to win the next election. And forget about trying to accomplish anything. Let's just make the other side look ridiculous. And you create extremes. So the other side's extremely one way. Well, then we have to do the opposite. And it's very hard to get something done when you start with that scenario. It's very frustrating as an American to watch this because, like you say, there's a lot of important decisions that aren't being made that'll have a big price tag later, and they're getting bigger instead of smaller, and it's just unfortunate. So,
yes, exactly right. Because while they are running around fighting over solutions to problems that don't exist, they're really very real problems that do exist, and boy, those are numerous, are getting worse and worse. You have very real problems with pensions and entitlements. The government borrowing situation in a decade will become critical. We're not investing in infrastructure. Our tax system is still a complete wreck. It's a scary time, and we just don't seem to have the ability or wherewithal to fix it. And it's too bad.
The U.S. demographics, is that negative or positive for GDP growth?
Oh, absolutely negative. The boomers were by far and away the biggest generation ever relative to their parents. My running joke on this is all boomers were raised in a family of approximately 14 kids. They were so traumatized by the experience, they all had 1.5 kids, which they excessively overparented, thus giving us the millennials. See how that works? But putting all that to one side, what has happened is our population pyramid has turned into a population column. Millennials are the biggest generation ever, but that is only because they are about 2% larger than the boomers. And if you look at, say, for example, growth in 25 to 54 year olds, over the course of the last 10 years, it hasn't grown. It's been flat. So we have a real problem on our hands. From a demographic standpoint, we're just not adding enough people to continue to fill jobs. And that's a problem. It's a problem from a financial perspective because who's going to pay all those bills? It's a problem from an employer's perspective. Hence, we have some of the tightest labor markets ever. And the solution to this, by the way, is clear: more immigrants. It's very simple. Now, if you want to debate how immigrants come to this country and on what basis—is it family, or is it skills, is it legal, or is it illegal? I'm happy to sit down and have that debate, as long as we all understand what we're debating is how to increase the number of immigrants coming to this country. Right now, obviously, this administration has an open antipathy and towards immigrants. I said that word wrong, but you know what I mean. Very open, very openly hostile, particularly to immigrants of, shall we say, darker shades than the administration. The net result of that, of course, is that immigration has really been slowing down, and it's taking a problem and making it even worse. Now, for your individual worker in the United States, there's an upside to all this, which, of course, is that wages are growing very nicely right now. It's one of the reasons that consumer spending has been nice and strong. So, you know, there is the upside, and businesses will be forced to invest more and more, because that'll be how countries or companies, excuse me, prosper in this environment. You have to invest in capital in order to increase output and continue to grow your profits. So there are positive sides of it, but it will constrain growth, except for, of course, these short-term bursts as created by unnecessary fiscal policy.
Innovations like robotics, artificial intelligence, 3D printing, self-driving cars, all that stuff. What's the short-term? Yeah. What is the short-term impact on the economy, and is it different? Is it different than the long-term impact?
No. Look, I mean, all these things you're talking about. First of all, you know, every time you turn around, someone's always screaming the end of work because of robotics. I mean, you can go all the way back to the Luddites. Remember them running around bashing farm machinery in the 1600s, 1700s, because they were sure that these machines would take all the jobs away from people. You know, the idea that technology causes massive dislocation of people, it's just not true. Look where we are today with all the information technology running around, the massive increases in productivity of manufacturing, and yet the unemployment rate in the U.S. has never been lower, right? Mm-hmm. So it's evolution, not revolution. There's nothing particularly unusual about this next wave of innovation. It's just more labor-saving innovation. I remember talking to my father once about this, and he was quite positive that all these jobs are going to be consumed by capital. And I pointed out to him, you know, there was a point in time when 90% of all jobs in the United States were in agriculture. 90% of people were being used just to feed ourselves. Today, of course, it's about 1%.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter. There are plenty of jobs out there. There's plenty of things for people to do, and that will continue to be. Right now, given the labor shortages we're seeing as a country, these should all be welcome relief. Now, mind you, when the next downturn comes, one of the downsides of this is that labor markets take longer to heal. We've seen this before. It's less of a long-term impact and more of a short-term impact, because what it means is when we do have recessions, the bounce back in employment is slower than it would have been, say, 20, 30 years ago. So that is an issue. But it's an issue that should be handled by appropriate policy wrapped around, of course, avoiding the recession in the first place, not allowing the kind of imbalances of tackling problems appropriately. And then, of course, in the context of the downturn itself, it's using appropriate fiscal and monetary policy to limit the overall impacts. So it can be handled on the other end if we have a responsible government, hence the problem.
Well, Dr. Thornburg, we have run out of time. I hope you get a voice at that level if you don't have one already, and maybe you can talk some sense into the group. I appreciate you joining us very much.
Always great to be here, Bruce.
Thank you.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate, Guaranteed Rate, and Nathan Chiboya, In a Day Development, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Jason Thorman with Coldwell Banker, Jennifer Buys Houses, Keystone CPA, LA South RIA, Las Brisas Escrow, Lawyers Title, Michael Ryan and Associates, New Western, NorCal RIA, NSDREI, Orange County Real Estate Investors, The Outspoken Investor, Pacific Premier Bank, Pasadena Phoebe, Pilot Limousine, SJREI, Spinnaker Loans, South OC RIA, Tri-County Association of Realtors, You Direct IRA Services. White House Catering. See isurvivedrealestate.com for event information.